now be deleted, and rather a subsection be added at the end of the amendment, a subsection D, stating that these costs shall be billed to the state or local agency and paid in the ordinary course of business. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Mr. Brooks, if I could ask, perhaps you could refresh my memory on this. When the state owes, and maybe it's just in the construction public contracting law, but I thought that when the state owes somebody money, that interest is paid on this amount owed, and it's some, and I think lobbyists from the Associated General Contractors during the high interest period put in about, you know, 18% per annum or 24-25% per annum. Does that apply to these billings?
No, these billings are strictly under Chapter 192, which provides for subpoena or consent access by state or local agency. And the existing statute says that they are entitled to reasonable charges. And the reason there's no interest provided for is that they get the charges up front before we get the information.
Well, suppose we were to do this now, and I assume that I think the financial institutions, they don't like your amendment. And what if we were to suggest something that, since we are putting dollar amounts in the statute, that we attach some sort of interest penalty if the billing isn't paid within 30 or 45 days?
We would, Mr. Chairman, we would support such an amendment.
Mr. Bronner, what do you think of that idea?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. One of the reasons that we resist removal of the prepayment, and in former days, we never insisted on prepayment. But there needs to be a discipline. This has become such a big problem for us, we've even printed a brochure for local governments on how they can cut their cost of discovery. What needs to happen when there is a discovery process, we need to know what they're looking for, and we can cut their costs. There needs to be a conversation in advance. If we know what they're looking for, we can give them an estimate, and we're perfectly satisfied in doing the work and then being paid if they pay. We have a situation in Southern Oregon that occurred just 2 weeks ago where the request came to an $1,800 bill, and we've received $5, and we are told, advised by the local government, that's it, guys, nothing else. We have published a bulletin saying to banks, you're only safe if you can get prepaid, because what's our recourse?
But don't you think that we're kind of taking care of a big part of the problem by, instead of just leaving it the phrase reasonable amount, that we're stating the amount that can be charged?
Mr. Chairperson, what we need is to insist that those that are seeking the records and the institution have a conversation prior to saying, give me everything for 20 years on John Jones. If we know what they're looking for, we can give them an idea so that there's an estimate. And it seems to me that once they, maybe a job order, I would assume that some way we have authorization to proceed and that we're paid. We've never signed on as a librarian, and this is certainly not a profit center. We'd like very much to comply with the investigatory process. And by the way, Representative Springer, 192 does provide an exception for a bona fide criminal investigation, and there is no charge under those circumstances. Could I respond to a couple other things, Mr. Shepard?
Go right ahead.
Questions that I've been asked, including Mr. Springer's last question. We, even today, don't insist on prepayment in many, many circumstances. And as a matter of fact, we would have resisted this bill in previous sessions, because reasonable cost to an institution that is not computerized is a whole lot different than an institution that is computerized and can locate. But it has become so significant to us that we're prepared to support the bill and put in specific guidelines, because we're not getting paid now, and it's become a very big problem for us. The Federal Reserve guideline that you have before seems fair. But not everyone can respond within those guidelines and even break even. And I need to point that out to you. The 20 cents per mile is largely our biggest expense, is the court appearances. Once we produce the documents, then there's a court appearance of a bank person to say that those are our documents. And that court appearance is normally, we're not reimbursed for. Many times we're not reimbursed. The reader that somebody asked about, that's the microfilm of the checks, and that is an expense to have that brought off the microfilm and reproduced. Mr. Springer, there is, Representative Springer, there is no bill that mandates that we must do business with anyone. We are in a fiduciary capacity to protect both our depositors and serve the public. And we make a check charge on occasion where we're at risk.
Representative Springer.
Well, we don't need to go too far into that subject today. At some point, I don't know if it's going to present itself in a bill or not, but I'd be curious in learning, is this consistent? Does it apply to all kinds of checks? For example, would it apply to a Social Security check or a check drawn upon the state of Oregon, a warrant? Or is it just private party checks?
Some of our biggest losses, Representative Springer, have been Social Security checks. We in Oregon have 63% of our Social Security payments on direct deposit. I wish we had 100%, because then Social Security checks are not stolen, but fraudulently using, forging Social Security checks have been a big problem for us. We would hope that we're providing services for the person on Social Security where those checks can be cashed free of charge if they would maintain some sort of a banking relationship. Mm-hmm. Okay. Be happy to discuss it with you at your convenience.
Okay.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll close the hearing. Are there any other people that wanted to testify in 2667 that may not have had the opportunity to sign up? Okay, we'll close the hearing on 2667. And now we'll go, we have with us this afternoon Judge Joseph. If you'd like to join us, and we will open the hearing on House Bill 2205. Chairman, you referred to 2205 as the first one you would be heard on.
Or 2619.
Well, Mr. Nass and I both would like to be away by 3 o'clock if possible to attend another meeting. Mr. Nass is the carrier for our purposes of 2205, and I would just assume that if you would like to go ahead on that bill.
Whichever you'd like to do first is fine with us.
I have already submitted written testimony and oral testimony at the last hearing, and would just answer any questions that you might have on this bill. I do have a letter from a lawyer who does a lot of appellate work, and he authorized me to make it available to the committee, which I would do at this time, and then answer any questions that you might have.
This is on 2619?
No, this is on 2205.
2205, okay.
If I may say, Chairman, with respect to 2205, what Mr. Nass has undertaken to do is to dig the appellate system out of a morass of technical details that were ignored. They were all there. All the details were there. But for years, they were ignored in favor of the flow of business. A few years ago, the Supreme Court instructed other courts to pay some attention to the technicalities of appellate procedure. We've been paying a great deal of attention to appellate procedure
dealing with bills that with statutes that have never been rationalized. Mr. Nass has undertaken, and I think very successfully, to simplify appellate procedure, and if in instances where he cannot eliminate the technicalities, he has sought to eliminate the impact of technicalities on the litigants. I think he has done it very, very well, and I would hope that we could get the legislation, all of which is technical in nature, passed, so that we could go about our business of deciding cases. Right now, we are the growth in motion practice devoted to substantive, dispositive questions, but not to the merits of the appeal, occupies substantially all of Mr. Nass's time and a very substantial portion of my time. There's nothing productive for the system. It's merely the system. And I commend the bill to your attention, and I hope that you will pass it.
Questions?
Representative Springer.
I think we may have an opportunity to hear from members of the bar. Perhaps I assume that members of the Bar Practice and Procedure Committee have had a chance to review this, but I'm curious. I know that during the interim, the Commission on the Judicial Branch discussed at some point at a meeting that I was able to attend and listen, some confusion that had arisen, I guess, just some jurisdictional issues in the Court of Appeals. Does this reflect some of that discussion within the Commission on the Judicial Branch, and will this help resolve some of those problems that apparently arose within the past couple of years as it relates to jurisdiction notice, the kinds of things that led to all kinds of traps for the unwary, yes, if you will, and all kinds of motions?
I really can't speak to the Commission on this, although I recall at one of the meetings I was able to attend that questions were raised, and it seemed to me it was in a context of there being a sort of technicalities the Commission ought not concern itself with. But perhaps one of the reasons I can't remember the Commission part is because I'm so boggled by these things day after day after day that what the Commission thinks about it is not very relevant. What Mr. Nass thinks about it and how he handles the problems and what his solutions to them are is extremely relevant, and that's been the context in which I thought of it. And the answer to your question is every provision in this bill is intended to get rid of the traps. Some of the technicality, there have to be some technical requirements, but they don't have to be applied in the draconian fashion in which the statutes are now written and which we're compelled to follow. And I think that flexibility with the requisite amount of technicality is what Mr. Nass's objective has been. I say it's my objective too, but let there be no doubt about whose work it is in that respect.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Nass. I would like to comment on Section 5 to make absolutely clear what we're trying to do here. It relates to what appears on page 3 of the bill, lines 21 through 26. Has to do with service of a copy of a notice of appeal on adverse parties, or on all parties who have appeared at trial. ORS 19.023 says that a notice of appeal shall be served on all parties who have appeared at trial. 19.033, as it presently reads, says that if you fail to serve a copy of the notice of appeal on every party who appeared at trial, your appeal is no good. The court does not have jurisdiction and you're out. This has resulted in dismissal of appeals where the party who was not served was someone dismissed early on in the action and really has no further interest in the case. We have attempted to ameliorate that by providing in Section 5 of the bill that service of the notice of appeal on all parties identified in the notice of appeal as adverse parties is the bottom line jurisdictional matter. Now, question becomes, okay, what if you fail to do that? Subsection 3 of the bill, which in so far as we're concerned with here, has not made any change, but as it would interrelate with the changes that we are making, it would set up a situation like this, that if someone who should have been served with a copy of a notice is not served with a copy of the notice, moves to dismiss the appeal as to him or her or it, the court, assuming the party can show prejudice, could but would not have to dismiss the appeal. The court may simply say or proceed the case that proceed with that party not being a party to the appeal, which would mean that the court could not affect any interest of that party. But if the prejudice were of such a magnitude, the court would have the power to dismiss the entire appeal. But again, it is necessary for the party to show some sort of prejudice from failing to be served with notice, rather than under the current law, simple or failure to get notice with or without any prejudice whatsoever will result in dismissal of the case. And I just wanted to make that point clear of what we're trying to do here.
Are there any further questions?
Jim, can you direct my attention to where that is provided in the bill?
Yes, it's in Section 5 on page 3, lines 21 through 26. And then Subsection 3 follows at lines 29 through 33.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, further questions? Now, let's see, Council, did we receive the fiscal impact statement on this?
On 2205?
Yes.
I contacted Fiscal Impact, and they said that they didn't have a fiscal impact ready.
Okay. I guess I'm interested in terms of Section 15. Mr. Nass will probably be the one that ends up, or somebody in his office, preparing that.
Yes.
That's going to be a wash, or are we talking about thousands and thousands of dollars here?
I'm informed by our fiscal people that the fiscal impact will be zero. The negligible amount of fees that we get from this group of litigants is offset by the amount of staff time that it takes to process motions to waive fees and all of the other cases.
Alrighty. I just wanted to... I had a note to myself on Section 17 of the bill. Now, Section 12, I think we're going to address in the next bill, 2619. We'll get involved in a discussion of Section 12 of this bill. Is that correct?
I had not understood those to be the same sections.
Okay.
The same, I think that bill that you're referring to deals with 19.180, I believe.
Oh, okay. Could you review one more time Section 17?
Yes. There is presently confusion in the law. In a criminal case, and the defendant wants to take an appeal, whether he or she may file the notice of appeal after verdict, but before entry of the trial court's judgment. 138.071 appears to say that the notice can be filed any time after verdict, which means that the person can be found guilty but has not been sentenced yet, and the judgment of the court has not been entered. I'm not sure of the exact section number. I believe it's 138.010 or 110, something of that sort, says that a defendant can appeal only from a final judgment. Well, that statute and this statute are inconsistent with each other. That's the first amendment at line 8 on page 8. The second amendment found on line 9 is referring to at what point does entry of the journal into the various records of the court trip the running of the 30-day appeal period. Presently, the statute says when the judgment or order appealed from was given or made. Well, given or made is a very vague term. We believe that entered in the journal is a far more clear term, which is also the term used in the civil statutes to trip the running of a 30-day period for entry of a judgment in a civil case, that is, entry in the trial court's journal.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Okay. We do have some other witnesses on House Bill 2205, but I'd like to hear from Judge Joseph on 2619, so we'll temporarily close the hearing on 2205.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I think you've probably heard my speech on this particular subject twice already. You recall that in the overview that the Chief Justice arranged for the committee, our message was, whatever you do, don't give the Court of Appeals more work to do. That was reiterated in a previous appearance by me at least once. And I certainly do not want to assault the committee's intelligence by going through the drill again. Unhappily for me, however, if I may say, this bill has the names of two members of this committee as sponsors on it. And I wish I knew why. Because I will add to what I said before about not giving the Court of Appeals more work, I'll ask a request that you not make us look silly or denigrate the kind of work we now do. I will satisfy myself today with quite a short statement, but I'm afraid it involves some numbers, and I've got to tell you the numbers again, because I'm going to reiterate it again and again and again every time I think this committee or any other committee is going to dump on us. In 1984, there were 3,794 new appeals filed in the Court of Appeals. We disposed of 3,759 cases. We produced written opinions in 593 of those cases. That's 10 judges produced full written opinions. Only 9 of those judges work full-time at producing opinions. One, myself, has enough administrative responsibility to give me an excuse not to write opinions so much. Again, I will tell you that the output of written opinions by judges of the Court of Appeals is the highest in the country. In addition to those full written opinions, we produced 169 shorter written opinions. By definition, an opinion in our court that is less than a typewritten page long is a per curiam opinion. Now, it is true that in disposing of almost 3,800 cases last year, which, by the way, was 10% over the year before, 1,600 of those cases, 1,650 of those cases, were decided without a written opinion. It is, as I said before, critical to the work of the Court of Appeals to keep it a collective court. If the legislature were actually to pass a bill that says that the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals may decide cases before it by means of memorandum decisions in writing with reasons stated, then somehow the time, the staff, the energy is going to have to be found to produce, last year it would have been 3,759 such memoranda or full opinions. Now, this committee, as any committee of this legislature, is concerned with fiscal impact. It was just asked about a while ago. I can guarantee you that two things will happen if a bill like this passes. One of them is that there will be a slowdown in the disposition of cases. We will not dispose of 3,759 cases in the year after this bill would become effective. We couldn't do that. There is no way we could do that and still make any contribution to the legal system. We handled 16.6% of our 1984 caseload in decisions from the bench, all of them criminal cases, and 27% by other affirmances without opinion, some of them, most of them criminal, many non-criminal. Even assuming that many cases could be still be dealt with briefly, the fiscal impact would be simply tremendous. In the first place, it would require, at a minimum, the addition of one full department of three judges and a full staff, which would in turn require substantial capital outlays, not the least of which would be finding a new location for the whole Court of Appeals. We are chock-a-block with people on the third floor of the Justice Building. Now, the Attorney General would love to have us leave the building. Probably get around to trying to force that very soon, probably shortly after the legislature adjourns. But in any event, you'd have to move all of us, and you'd have to pay for it. You'd have to find the money for it. And I can tell you from our experience that we're not talking about a little bit of money. The estimates for replacing a department of the court with appropriate staffing run just a rough figure, in excess of $1 million for the next biennial, even if we don't get salary increases. Now, you will probably hear today from other people, some of whom are sitting behind you, that it would all be very easy to do. We could use checklists. I had said earlier, do not make the Court of Appeals look silly with a checklist. That it isn't difficult to write something in every case. They haven't tried it. They apparently do not have any understanding or any interest in how the Court of Appeals does its business. The simple truth is now that unless you are prepared vastly to expand the number of judges and the staff and the capital outlay, it can't be done. But more importantly, it shouldn't be done. It shouldn't be done. I think I used the expression the first time I appeared before this committee, and I'll use it again. We get a fearful lot of crap. And for anybody to suggest that we should take the time, expend the energy, and do the work of explaining why crap is crap completely escapes me. That can only be said by people who simply do not know what they're talking about, and for reasons of their own, think there's something beautiful, glorious, and yes, highly desirable in a written opinion in every case. I ask the committee, if you want, I'll crawl around the room on my knees, I'll do anything at all, but don't do this. For one reason, I could say as a personal matter, I wouldn't work on a court that had to write an opinion in every case. I do work on a court now that writes more opinions per judge than any court in the land, that has the shortest turnaround time of any court in the land, and has a remarkably successful record of preserving its cases when they're reviewed by the Supreme Court of Oregon. I ask you not to do this. Thank you.
Questions from the committee, Representative Bunn.
Judge Joseph, I agreed with your testimony concerning the problems of fiscal impact, location, the problems that the bill would create. I don't happen to believe that all of the cases you don't give a written opinion on are crap.
No, I didn't say all of them.
No, I realize that. And I also don't believe that a number of people who feel there should be more written opinions don't understand or aren't interested in how the process works. I personally believe if we had the dollar resources, we should have more written opinions. I have had cases before the Court of Appeals that I hope weren't crap, it would have been very helpful as a private attorney to understand why the decision was made, both in terms of representing clients, in terms of appeal, in terms of future work before the courts. Do you see any way that we can, without mandating this extent of action by the court, do something to get more written opinions, or do you feel that we need any more written opinions?
Well, we don't need, we write to...
Contra to the proposed thrust of House Bill 2619, which is the principal subject of my reason for being here. So one or the other must yield, or you're going to have two conflicting statutes. Now, I will not attempt to cover all points possible, but one of the committee brought up a point that I think is a very valid one. In essence, the question was asked Judge Joseph, why, if you've gone through the decision-making process and made up your mind, you must have reached a reasoned decision, and therefore, your work is behind you. With that, I agree. Now, it may take me a long time to make up my mind about something. Once I have made up my mind, it doesn't take me very long to set down the reasons for my decision. It may be that I would not like to have those reasons made public. Nonetheless, if I set down the reasons for my decision, it's zip, zip, zip. Another thing that Judge Joseph said, and to which I take exception, he referred to a number of cases that came before them as crap. This is quite possibly so. We have a number of inmates at Oregon State Law School on State Street who are filing all kinds of habeas corpus, you name it. And it is true that probably the bulk of that stuff is orger. And I can see his point. But at the same time, I do not go along with the suggestion that legitimate appellants should be buried in the fallout from all this garbage of which he's speaking. Nor do I agree with him when he said that all three judges have made up their mind and it's so clear there's no point in our sitting down and writing a summary of it. In other words, anybody could understand it. Well, now that is not necessarily so. Among those who were unable to understand why the Court of Appeals did what it did, and who have said so in print, are Oregon Supreme Court Justice Hans Lindy, Oregon Supreme Court Justice Berkeley Lent, Oregon Supreme Court Justice Jake Tanzer, Oregon Supreme Court Justice J.R. Camel. Now, since there's no way in which these types of comments from the Supreme Court are indexed, you just have to stumble across them. I've stumbled across instances, the last of which was in 1984. I've recited them in detail in my written statement, and I have sent in photocopies of the material which reflected the agonizing that the Supreme Court justices were going through trying to find out what this controversy was all about so that they would know what to do with it. Justice Lindy gives us a remedy. He suggests his concurring opinion in Getman versus SAIF 289 Oregon 609, that this can be done in one or two sentences. And he cites as an example of what he's talking about another case that I have attached to the material I sent you from the Court of Appeals, case of Hold versus Duraflake Company. This case consists of four sentences totaling 12 and a half printed lines. Justice Lindy pointed out that the subject was adequately covered by merely the opening and closing sentences, which consist of a total of seven printed lines. So, when I say that I have never been able to understand why the Court of Appeals did what it did in any affirmed without opinion case that I have ever reviewed, I don't feel ashamed, because I have some eminent company, apparently.
Mr. Collins, could I ask you at this point, now you practice mainly in the Medford area,
yes.
I assume. Now, and I'm certain you appreciate the workload of our Court of Appeals. Is there a particular area of the law that you run into that it would be most helpful, divided up between criminal agency type orders, decisions, or civil type property law, etc.? Where do you find it troublesome to you that you would introduce this bill? Is it one particular area?
Where I have personally found it troublesome. Yes. Though I might give the caution that just because I have personally found it troublesome in those areas doesn't mean that those are the troubled areas or all of them.
But you see, we don't get to see you and people from the hinterland, shall we say, very often, so it's very important to us.
Right. Where I have seen the problem arise, and was most intimately involved with it, were two cases, both in which I was representing corporate clients, both of which had competent legal departments. One of them was a common carrier, and one of them was one of the largest general contractors in the world. The common carrier was affirmed without opinion for about $70,000. They asked me if I could suggest any reason why the case should not be appealed. I said, on the contrary, I think it should, particularly in view of a recent Supreme Court decision on the same subject. So this went up, and it was affirmed without appeal and or without opinion. There was no problem there, because a common carrier is practically a professional litigant. They're used to being sued all the time. Now, the general contractor was a different proposition. The general contractor's legal staff had reviewed that thing, both in the Middle West, where the main office is, and in New York City, where they have a large installation. They were of the opinion that this was a good appeal. This was the $750,000 number. So I was instructed to appeal, and I did. Affirmed without opinion. So they said, what do we do now? I said, the next step procedurally would be to petition the Supreme Court for review. So they discussed it, and then they got back to me with this message. This judgment is accruing interest at the rate of somewhere between $18 and $19 a day, 7 days a week. The appeal has been pending for a long time. The summary treatment we got in the Court of Appeals has destroyed our confidence in the Oregon judiciary. We think that as a matter of economics, we should pay the money now and walk away from it. So when you're balancing interests, I think you run into this. I appreciate what Judge Joseph has said about having a staff and a workload problem. But I have two things to say to that. The problem is really not one of the convenience of the judges. The court system is a public service. The problem is one of public service, and the problem is one of the public's right to know. What I said about the people who walked away from the $750,000 is illustrative of the point that is made so often by the British judges, that it is, of course, important that justice be done, but it is equally important that it be demonstrated that justice has been done. That's what preserves their confidence in our court system. If it takes more money, and I disagree, I see no fiscal impact here, but if it takes more money, the public still has a right to know. It's their court system we're talking about.
Let me see if there's questions from the committee. Counsel?
Yeah, Mr. Collins, I have one or two questions. First of all, do you know of any other states that deal with affirmations without opinions, some cases without opinions?
Yes. The state of California, I have limited research resources in the provinces, and those are limited to California code for out-of-state material. California has had this same requirement for many years, perhaps a century. It has worked well. And when I say this same requirement, I say it literally. I plagiarized the language from California code. The judges down there think nothing of writing an opinion. They don't necessarily restrict themselves to the one or two liner or the seven liner. As Judge Joseph said, they write long opinions which they do not publish. And that does not seem to have had any adverse effect on their judicial system. I might parenthetically add there that non-published opinions are the rule rather than the exception in the federal court system. The only people who publish the opinions officially in the federal court system are the justices of the United States Supreme Court. Getting back to California, I supplied you with a case in which a California court discusses the reasons for that requirement. The case of People versus Rojas, R-O-J-A-S. The California court said this, that the reason for the rule is designed to ensure that the reviewing court gives careful thought and consideration to the case, and that the statement of reasons indicate that the appellant's contentions have been reviewed and conscientiously, as distinguished from inadvertently, rejected. Part of our system of checks and balances. We, the public, look to the courts to protect us from the unlawful acts of the executive and the legislature. We look to the legislature to protect us from the unlawful acts of the executive and the courts. And we look to the executive to protect us from the unlawful acts of the courts and the legislature.
Let me see if there are some other questions. And committee members, Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Although, Mr. Collins, we talked about this some ahead of time, it was prior to my hearing Judge Joseph's testimony, and I would be interested in your response to his comment that no opinion is better than a summary opinion, that a summary opinion excludes careful writing and, I don't know, whatever else he said, caution. Yes.
I don't agree with him. What we're talking about, or what I'm talking about, and what he's talking about, are apples and oranges. What I'm talking about is an opinion about that long in print. He's talking about a full-scale opinion, not a seven-line one. I'm just saying if they meet the California minimum standard, that is quite adequate. Justice Lindy said so, too.
Thank you.
I might elaborate on that in one respect. He said to beware of the head notes. The head notes are wrong. If you look in the Illinois reports, the Illinois appellate reports, just for example, I don't know where else they do it, you'll find that in many instances they say print head notes only, or print syllabi only, as they call it. That gives a case summary.
Well, Mr. Collins, unless there's questions from the members, I certainly want to thank you for taking your time to be with us today. I think the committee will take a short recess, and we will come back with Mr. Reel, and we do have, I think, two other witnesses that did come in from the South and would like to testify, so we'll recess for about 10 minutes. Committee, I'll come to order, please. We'll finish the hearing on House Bill 2619. I believe Mr. Reel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just by way of introduction, let me say, first of all, that I do mostly civil practice. I'm the municipal judge in the city of Beaverton, and I consequently do not do much in the way of criminal cases. In my role as a lawyer. However, I do practice about two-thirds of my time, and I practice in the civil area. I guess I'm from the hinterland since I'm from Beaverton, so perhaps I can get a more favorable ear. I also, since George is, would say that while he may disagree, I think I am somewhat experienced in the appellate area, and I do appreciate and I think I understand the problems of the Court of Appeals. I have probably drafted, co-authored, and authored about 150 briefs on appeal. I have personally argued perhaps 25 to 30 of those cases. After graduating from law school, I did clerk for Tom Tung on the Supreme Court. Justice Tung was noted for his criticism of the Supreme Court and not working hard enough. And while he was on the court, he was well known as the hardest working judge on that court. And I believe his law clerk had to meet his expectations in that regard. He regularly wrote majority opinions in 50 to 60 cases. And in addition to that, he volunteered oftentimes to help other judges complete their opinions, and they were the published author, but he in fact did a majority of the work. He also regularly sat as a pro tem on the Court of Appeals to assist them. So I think I am quite familiar with the process, and I appreciate the workload problems that Justice Joseph is referring to. Unfortunately, I come from a completely different viewpoint. I think AWOPing, as it's now euphemistically called, is frustrating in the least and unfair to the litigants at the most. As you are well aware, in order to appeal, you first must pay fees. You do have to have a transcript prepared, which is extremely expensive. You have to meet some very stringent rules set down by the appellate courts regarding preparations of briefs that have to be in a very formal format. The client wants to see those things, and it's my practice to copy the client on the notice of appeal on all letters and particularly on the briefs. We have the option, of course, to come down and orally argue, and I don't know of very many lawyers who are serious about their cases that waive the oral argument. I quote to my clients as a minimum on the simplest appeal of $2,500 to $3,500, and that's to me a very simple case with a few assignments of error, and that's not at $150 an hour, that's at $80 an hour. We oftentimes wait several months before a decision is rendered, and I'm sure all of the lawyers in Oregon appreciate the fact that the Court of Appeals has apparently the fastest turnaround time in the world, but perhaps we don't need to be quite so fast, and we could be a little bit more thorough as far as giving it a decision. What happens oftentimes is that after going through this long process, detailed process, you get a one-page checklist form that says you lost. We're affirming without opinion. We're not telling you why. It's unfair. It should be corrected. We're not asking in this bill, by the way, I'm just a lawyer speaking for it. I'm not on any committee that is supporting it. I'm not associated with the bar in a formal way other than as a member. But all that this bill is asking for is some short explanation. And the Court of Appeals does that. There are many, many examples that we could cite to you of the short opinion. I have one that I brought with me, which, interestingly enough, was an opinion by a short opinion, less than a half a page, by Judge Van Humusen, stating what the issue was, that there was no constructive purpose to be served by having a detailed opinion. And after reviewing the record, they affirm the decision of the trial court, and they cite seven cases. At least that gives the lawyer and the party some reference. Did they accept our cases that we were citing to them, or did they accept the other side? Let's look at those cases and see what they say, and then we know what to do in the future. We know why this particular case was lost. Judge Joseph wrote a long dissent saying that in this particular case, there should be a full explanation. The problem that I see is that it's inconsistent. You don't know when you're going to get AWOP. I have had cases where many other lawyers have stated the opinion that this is an appealable case, that there are substantial issues, and I've gotten AWOP. There are other cases in which I have thought I didn't have much chance at all, and I've gotten a long opinion, sometimes against me and sometimes in favor, but there doesn't seem to be a consistent pattern of when an opinion is written and when it's AWOP. As I said before, I think that the fact that the Court of Appeals has the fastest turnaround time is good, but we don't have to be the best in that department. Maybe we could be the best in having reasoned opinions and at least short opinions that tell us why we lost. The only thing that I've heard Judge Joseph say is that the workload is just too much, and don't increase the workload by this method. From my observation and my time here in Salem, working for the appellate courts, I don't buy that. I don't think that it's going to increase the workload. In almost every case, the law clerk has prepared some memorandum stating how the case should come out and why. There's no reason why that memo or something similar to it could not be modified by the judge and adopted by the court. I would say to the legislature and to this committee that the Court of Appeals does need relief, but this isn't the way to get it. Perhaps because of budgetary problems or other reasons, the Court of Appeals has decided this is one way they're going to try to cut down some work, but this isn't the way to solve it. The way to solve it is to do something other than forcing AWOPs, and I'm sure it's budgetary, and I'm sure we're talking about money and some added staff. I think there are some other bills before the legislature and perhaps this committee that I'm not following in particular, but I've heard about that would add some staff, and not necessarily judges, but some support staff and equipment and so on. And I would endorse whatever Judge Joseph would say about those particular bills, but I would not say that we should continue with the AWOP. On the question of frivolous appeals, there are some, I'm sure, very few lawyers practicing in the civil area, in the area of tort litigation, contracts, personal injury, and so on. I don't think you'll find very many judges or lawyers telling you that those types of cases that are appealed are frivolous. I would suspect that the large majority of cases that are in that category are criminal cases, and perhaps, although I'm not the sponsor of the bill, perhaps I would suggest to you that it might be a compromise to exclude criminal cases from the AWOP procedure. I think if you look at the list that was submitted by Frank Logeson, you'll see that a substantial portion of the AWOP cases are criminal cases. The other substantial categories are divorce and workers' compensation. And of course, those are matters of de novo review, and that presents other issues that I think the legislature maybe has under consideration and are perhaps some hot potatoes that you have to deal with. There are methods, and there is a statute that deals with frivolous appeals. I'm sure Representative Bunn is well aware of the fact that if an appeal is truly frivolous, there are sanctions. I think it's by way of increased damages to the judgment that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court can award. The Bar Association, I'd like to clarify a little bit about the Bar Association's position as I understand it. That is that the matter was brought before the convention last fall, and as is customary, after a long day, the number of lawyers in the room dwindles, and it was down to around 200 lawyers, I believe, and a bare majority of those passed a resolution regarding AWOPing. But that's very common for the bar to vote with small numbers. I don't think you should put a lot of stock in the fact that there weren't more than 200 lawyers there. But the majority that were there and voted said, in effect, we're not going to come out directly opposed to AWOPing, but it ought to be looked at very carefully. And I think one of the reasons they took that position is because George Joseph was there, and as he is wont to do, he made a very good presentation. Finally, the practice and procedure proposal that's been submitted to you by Frank Logeson, I would just say to you that there's some question as to whether the full committee does agree in total with the position that AWOPing ought to be completely wiped out. I think the position probably is that's the majority view. There are some that maybe there's a compromise position somewhere, but the emphasis is toward let's do something about this AWOPing. I don't think you'll find a majority of any of these committees or the bar saying we want to leave AWOPing the way it is. The last thing I would say is that apparently Ted Falk is here from one of those big firms in, that's not in the hinterlands, and he wrote an article in the Bar Journal. Judge Joseph did, and Justice Peterson did also, but he wrote an article against the AWOP practice, which I think he has submitted to you. He's here. I don't know if you'll have time to take his testimony. He told me that he did not sign up, but he intended to and would like to speak. But I would commend the article to you if you have it. It is a very well done research job that cites statutory reasons why AWOPing should not be continued, constitutional reasons, and just general good appellate practice. I think if you look at the authorities across the country, you'll see that almost all of them say that there should not be this practice of AWOPing, and I don't think such courts as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals allow that type of decision making. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions from the committee? Representative Bunn.
This is just off the top of my head, and I haven't thought it through, but taking into account Judge Joseph's concern for the fiscal impact, which I do, I think there's a real workload problem there. Would it be rational, perhaps, to suggest that a certain percentage of the cases had to be given in written form so that you knew that there was going to be a thrust towards the bulk of those, and then, in effect, they choose those that they think are flaky that they're not going to give the opinion?
I don't think that solves the problem of your client relation. I don't think it solves the public perception. I think you'd have to do it, Representative Bunn, on a type of case basis, such as criminal, divorce, domestic relations, whatever, rather than saying just a percentage.
Representative Bunn.
Well, the concern I have, and I tend to agree with you, is that more as the workload has gotten heavier, they have used this as a method of dealing with cases and not giving the written opinions. But if we go the other way and say they've all got to be written, all civil have got to be written, I think we do place an additional burden that is a real problem for them. I just like to see some solution.
I think the opinion is already there. I think the short summary is already there. It's a matter of simply setting it forth, sending it to the parties. And I think a checklist, I'm personally not much in favor of the checklist idea. I think a short summary is much better, but a checklist probably could work in a large number of cases.
How much do those judges...